Good evening. Good evening to those in the hall, and a very good evening too to the people watching on the internet, both here in Perth and indeed all around the world. So welcome along. And I'd once again just like to start by reminding everybody that we do have the care line open tonight up in the care house, which is just behind the centre here. In Perth, the care lines are open, and there's listeners there, ready, willing to take your call here tonight. So, if anybody has any issues at all that they'd like to ventilate or talk about, there are people there waiting right at this very moment. Quite chilly here in Perth tonight, so. I hope wherever you're watching this from tonight, that it's a little bit warmer than here. But we're warm in the hall, though, anyway. We've got the heaters going, and it's working well. And I just trust that the listeners up in the house, too, are nice and warm and comfortable and ready to take your calls. So tonight, I'm going to... talk about a topic that I really love, a topic that I've been really working with ever since I've been a marriage celebrant here at the Buddhist Centre, and that goes right back to 1986. And I have done weddings here for many years and married many, many couples over the years. And oftentimes I do them, you know, sometimes by myself, but very often I do weddings. We do weddings together with Ajahn Brahm. So it's a situation where I can do the official part of the marriage, and Ajahn Brahm does the part that he talks about keeping people together. You know, really wonderful. They're really wonderful ceremonies. It's been just a joy to do that. I've had to give it away. I did my last wedding ceremony last Saturday morning, and it was really just there that I started just thinking that I might just talk about one of the aspects that I talk about sometimes in weddings, and that's really just the wonder and the mystery of what we're all involved in with this, and just how it relates to Dharma. Because, I mean, at one level, you might think that this is a fairly simple and easy thing that we're kind of involved in. We get habituated to the way that we live our lives, you know, getting up each morning, eating our food, running off to work, earning our money, consuming, buying things. It all becomes quite habitual. And we just tend to think this is just ordinary. Just an ordinary life. You know, you can come along here to the centre, and this hall's quite a wonderful hall, but it's, you know, it's relatively ordinary. We know what buildings are, and we know what it is to sit, and all of these sorts of things, that the way that we live our lives is a very habitual kind of a situation. It's conditioned into us really right from our birth. And, you know, perhaps I might sort of touch on that a little bit more as we're going along here a bit. But really, when you think about it, just living our life here on this earth, when you do start to think about it, it's really quite, well, in my world, or what I think about this when I sort of think about it, is that it's really quite bizarre. Because if you think about the idea of just sort of taking yourself up above this hall, and you're just looking down on the hall, and you can see that's maybe all right. You can see that it's located in Nollamara here, and we're on the western part of Australia, and you know, if you go a bit higher, you'll be able to see the continent of Australia, and then you see that Australia is in a world. It's on a globe that's spinning, a spinning globe. And then as you go out a bit further, you'll notice that there's a moon there, and it actually looks quite full tonight too, probably coming up to the full part of the moon. I'm not really quite sure of just when that is, but probably tomorrow night, I would think, by the look of it. So, you know, you start to see already now, that's a bit of a mystery already, isn't it? Here we're on this planet that's spinning, and there's the moon. And then you come out a bit further and you see that we're just one of nine planets, or eight planets, however you want to regard poor old Pluto. But you see that we're in this sort of cycle going round a sun. And this sun is kind of blazing away. And then as you come out further, you can see that we're actually in a space. And this little solar system here is just one little solar system in what we know now to be countless, countless systems. And even the galaxy that we live in, this Milky Way galaxy, we see that we're just in one little part of a spiral arm of this galaxy. And then as you pull out even further than that, as we can do when we photograph the universe, you can start to see that this galaxy that we live in here, this galaxy that contains all of this, already just huge, huge astronomical numbers that we're talking about here. But you see, this is just one little part of the whole of the systems that we live in, these spatial systems where there's, as you move out, you notice there's galactic clusters and way that sort of even galaxies themselves interact. Indeed, even the Earth is in a gravitational attraction with what we call the local group of galaxies, which sort of includes the galaxy of Andromeda and certainly there is the two little island galaxies that surround our Milky Way. The large and the small Magellanic Clouds are classed as irregular galaxies that are there in gravitational attraction with the Milky Way. So we go from this place in our hall here, kind of thinking that everything's normal, and then all of a sudden you kind of, you know, you broaden your horizon, broaden what we're looking at, and you can see that this is really quite a strange thing that we're all involved in here, isn't it? It isn't just normal. It's actually quite mysterious. This whole involvement that we're in with everything that's in our world is mysterious. And I kind of look at that and you wonder, I mean, the scientists and that think that maybe they'll be able to explain many things, and they do try to do that, but I'm very skeptical about whether they'll ever find really what it all means or what it's trying to point to. Certainly they do. I really love physics myself. I love to kind of follow all of this stuff, but when you really think about it, I don't know that we're really ever going to be able to measure what it is that we're looking at here and be able to sort of make sense of it. But so it goes as well, you know, when I sort of think about this back in terms of relationships and the marriages that I do, I very often look at the couples, and it's really wonderful to be with people too, be with people that are in love with one another, and you're working with them. We generally need to do a little bit of prepare, so we kind of do some marriage preparation. And so, you know, I get to know them quite well, really, the couples that I get, that I marry, and usually it ends up quite an intimate occasion when the ceremony actually comes along. But it always astounds me when I'm looking at people, just, you know, why did you choose that person? Why did that girl choose that boy? Or why did that boy choose that girl? You know, what kind of brings, and sometimes it's just the certainty. You know, this is the person I want to spend my life with. You know, it's there's a certainty there. And for me, when I look at it, it's really quite mysterious just how people will come together like that. I'm not sure that they really even know themselves sometimes. It's just that everything, the chemistry works and the conditions and the way that they have lived their lives, sometimes very, very different. Sometimes very different people marrying each other. Sometimes people that come from very structured places, from homes that are so structured. and then other people that come from places that are, you know, you could say almost chaotic. Might be a lot of fun, but almost chaotic. And these people will sometimes be attracted to each other, and it's just astonishing, really, how the universe brings people like this together. And it's really a big, for me, when I look at it, it's just such a mystery. It's a mystery indeed. But even just thinking about that with relationships, you know, when oftentimes when people are very different, you know, sometimes it can be quite exciting to be with someone that's, you know, if you've lived your life in a very structured way, you've maybe had strict parents and so on, and you've got this structure to your life, and then you can meet someone who's freewheeling. It can be quite exciting. Oh, I'd love to be with this person. This person's going to teach me heaps. And the freewheeling person maybe look back, you know, and they kind of see the sometimes the vagaries or the trouble that sometimes living your life in a chaotic way like that will bring. Sometimes they'll look at the person with the structure and think, oh, gee, I'd love to be with that person. Love to be able to live my life that way and have all that sort of certainty and determination going on in my life. But sometimes, you know, after a year or so together, you know, sometimes that structure can get quite hard to live with. You know, if you're if you've been brought up in a structured way, and then all of a sudden you're married to this sort of wild man or a wild woman, it's very, very difficult. So all of these things, we sort of look at all this in marriage preparation, of course, and look towards it. But you see that. Well, I was just sort of writing to someone today, actually, that was sort of writing to ask me about certain things in a relationship, and I was just reminded to write to them about Joseph Campbell. What Joseph Campbell is sort of a fairly eminent sort of sociologist, has written some wonderful books, the Hero's Journey and all of that. But he says that people think that marriage is like a lifelong love affair where you're going to get everything that you want. And he said, and it's not. You know, he said, marriage is an ordeal. And it's an ordeal that transforms us, totally transforms us. And in many ways, that's right too, isn't it? And really, that's what the universe is doing to us all of the time. We're kind of always involved in this mystery of what we get involved with and just, you know, what it's where it takes us to, and oftentimes we just don't know. Certainly, when you look at the bigger picture of the universe itself and all of the galaxies and the things like that, it is just such a mystery. I mean, I look at it and I think, you know, Alfred Hitchcock or any of the sort of the film writers couldn't really think up a more bizarre situation than what we actually live in this universe. It's really it's quite amazing. But yet here it is, and here we are. We're here in this universe, and we're all trying to make sense of it, trying to make sense of our lives and just what it means. And indeed, this is how it was for the Buddha, of course, as well. Back all those years ago, 2,600 years ago, he had really the same thoughts about all of this. And I suppose for him, he was, you know, as we all know, he was born into a fairly well-to-do and wealthy family, in as much as that he was the son of the local king, the king of the Sakyan clan, and he was a prince. So he really wanted for nothing as a young man. His name was Siddhartha Gautama, of course, then, but before he became the Buddha. But he was sort of born into this sort of wealth. And I suppose most of us think, when you look at someone like that, you might think, oh, gee, well, I wish I was like that. You know, I wish I could be a prince or a princess or have servants and people waiting on me and all the money that you want. And, you know, he had a summer palace and he had a winter palace and probably the best horses. not only that, he was quite handsome too, so the stories go, and he was able to, to be quite the warrior, you know. So, he was pretty well regarded. So you'd say his life was pretty good, but even with that, though, he's still, he went out of the palace, didn't he? He went out of the palace and saw the four heavenly messengers, and they were just people that represented old age. They came out and there was this old person that he supposedly saw. It says in the suttas, for the first time. Now, I think that's probably not quite right. I'm sure that he would have known what an old person was, but maybe this day he just saw it for the first time. Oh, this is old age, I'm going to get old too. And then he saw someone that was sick, and that would have been quite prominent, I imagine, around the foothills of the Himalayas and the northern part of India in those days. Even though in those days, though, too, it was a very enlightened time. There was a lot of good stuff going on, a lot of research and searching, and people seemed to be quite open to all of that, But anyway, that was the second heavenly messenger, and the third heavenly messenger he saw was death, and certainly we know about the funeral pyres and the way that people are, the way that the people of that part of the world honour and practice their death rituals. So it would have been easy for him to see, and really it said that it was the first time he saw that. And then finally he saw the mendicant monk, and that kind of really turned his head. I mean, here is a prince. I looked at it and all of a sudden, it's probably a little bit like the relationships, here we are, kind of someone probably quite wealthy, structured and everything, and then all of a sudden he sees this person here and, I want to be like him. I want to be like that mendicant monk, because he could see that mendicant monk was really had the ability and the standing in his life, the way that he'd let go of everything, the way that he didn't have to, keep himself presenting properly and all of that sort of thing. He could see that there was some real virtue in this, what this chap was doing. So that's really when how the Buddha left the palace, and and he actually really even went, probably worth just saying for the sake of the talk tonight too, that he went from there after a few years of learning meditation, and he learned from some of the best teachers that were around at the time, and there was a lot of good meditation teachers then. But he actually ended up deciding that sort of doing it all that way just wasn't right either. So he decided to really go right to the extreme, where he would start to wear a hair shirt and really abuse himself to try and push his way through. Push his way through in a way that where he was really trying to break through what this human condition is. So he used to sort of just eat old sort of coarse leaves and sort of just enough food to keep him alive. And it's sort of said that he really ended up becoming quite quite thin. If you look at some of the imagery over in Bangkok, especially in the Golden Temple over there, you see there's quite a row of these emaciated Buddha statues, and you can sort of see. It was even said that he could probably put his hand in his stomach and touch his backbone. Such was his, the way he'd kind of let himself go and the way that he'd thrashed himself. So. But he ended up, when he was doing all of that too, he realised that finally he came to the point where he thought, this is not the right way either. It's not right. So he tested the extremes, if you like, the extremes of what he could do. He had all the the luxury that he could probably want in his life, and maybe the hedonism, the hedonistic life that he was living. And he'd also had the had that part of the life where he really had nothing at all, and he was just really abusing himself in the end. So then he thought, what about the middle way? And this is why Buddhism has this, why it has this epithet. The Buddhism is really the path of the middle way between extremes. And it wasn't long after he realised that, that he actually became enlightened. So when we think about all of that, and just putting it back together with what I was just sort of talking to about this mystery of the universe and the mystery of our lives, the mystery of our of what we're doing here, just why are we born? You know, who am I? You know, you start to look at all that And what the Buddha chose was this middle way between extremes. And this turns out for me to be really quite a it's a wonderful thing that he discovered, because as I mentioned, this it did eventually lead him to his enlightenment. The fact that he was enlightened. So the way that, of course, that he did that was just through this meditation and making himself very calm and peaceful. So where did he go to in his mind? You can maybe think about this in terms of the middle way. And he went between the extremes of the past and the future. So, you know, he realised himself when he was sort of looking at all things in the past that the past really is a time that's gone, it's finished. I mean, there are many things that we can learn from the past, there's no question about that. But the reality of the actual living, the way that we can experience whatever we experienced in the past, that's not possible, it's gone. It's dead and finished, dead and gone. So the past is really like that, isn't it? It's something, when Ajahn Brahm talks about the past, he talks about that as this, if we're like carrying around corpses on our back, carrying around corpses of the past all of the time. We're always burdened with what we want to think about in the past. And yet when you think about the future, it's the same thing. The future, well, not it's the same thing, but opposite, really. But the future is really yet to come. It's not here yet. So we might have expectations and we might have dreams and ideas like that, but the reality of the future is just not here yet. So when you start to contemplate like this, as the Buddha probably did, you start to see that this middle way applies perfectly to this present moment, right now. Right here and now, even right in this relationship that we're forming here in this hall together, just in the same way that maybe couples that come together with their relationship, when they're that relationship that they're forming right in the moment. But you can also see that while I guess that's for marriage couples, is just sort of coming back to that again, when you look at them like that. I mean, when you're meeting someone new and it's all fresh and lovely and you're kind of excited and I just need to be with this woman, need to be with this man. I can't live without her, or I just need to be there right now, because, you know, it's all, you're kind of and our bodies are kind of work that way too, of course, anyway, the way that our DNA and everything is, the evolution that's happened to us over the year, we're kind of like that. It's sort of in nature's interest to make sure that we've got couples that want to be together so that there's progeny and so that there's new babies born and everything like that. But it is, you know, that it is quite exciting, isn't it, when you see that. I mean, even being around doing these marriages, it is such a beautiful thing. It's just lovely to see this this joy that people have when they're together and want to be together. But and I suppose a good marriage is really when that can be sort of carried forward in a way where this is when it does start to abate, when all that excitement starts to settle down, and you're just living with each other, and then you start to fall back on your own resources, just where, you know, when you're being pushed and your boundaries are being pushed, you know, because this is certainly, well, as Joseph Campbell said, you know, this is the ordeal part, the ordeal of marriage, where you really need to start understanding yourself more and to start allowing your partner to be more to be able to express themselves without trying to change them, or, you know, I don't like it when you do that stuff. Yeah, but I've always done this. This is what I know, but I used to like it then, but I don't like it now. I don't like it when you do that, you know. So, you know, these sorts of trials that come up for us, we this is what we start to work with, is our boundaries are being pushed. But all the time, if you kind of take the point of the middle way, we are really trying all the time just to live with this presence, to live in the present, to live right now. Because we, you know, when you kind of start thinking about this, you can see very clearly and you can feel and experience it too. It's not just in your head, it's also emotionally. Emotionally, you can start to see that that to be peaceful, to be happy, to have this joy, you know, it does come in the package of the present moment, and you start to sort of see the dangers of the extremes, because certainly you can, you know, and I think you even see that today a lot with a lot of the mental illness and so on that we have around here now, around in our lives these days, just with, you know, the extremes of depressions, which is usually, depressions are always usually things that relate to the past. You know, I wish I hadn't done that, or why have I done that? You know, why have I, the shame of stuff you've done. And then, of course, the opposite of a depression, the anxiety really is, that's all usually about the future. Worried about what's going to happen, worried about what I might do tomorrow. Am I going to have enough money next year? All of these things. So, you know, you get these dualities that start to form, the anxieties and the depressions. And really these dualities, you start to see how they do operate in the extremes, you know, and you also start to see, as you're operating in these extremes, you start to see as you kind of hold on, just as the Buddha did. He was holding on to born into his life of luxury and the hedonism and the wonder of all of that, but yet this other side was also presenting himself for him. There's a duality there. There always is. Whenever we sort of move to one thing, the other thing sort of pops up. It's just a natural, the natural way that the earth works, or that the world works, that nature works. You know, and it happens even in the physical world. You know, for those of you that are a little bit interested in physics or science, you see the same thing there. There's, you know, you don't get any particles, any physical particle at all that doesn't have an opposition, have an opposite. Everything does. You know, whether it's an electron that goes around an atom, there's always that opposite of a positron. It has that. It naturally has that. Is protons and antiprotons. Every particle that comes, every elementary particle that comes into existence in this world has an opposite. Even to the extent that you can look at it really right through the whole, you know, through the whole of really physics. And, you know, we see that there's matter and antimatter. This is so well established now. It's not, you know, that we know that this is the reality of what we live with. But the same thing really goes if you look at the way that Jung and some of these wonderful psychologists over the years have studied our the way that we think and the way that we and the conditions that we get. You know, there's it's the same thing there. Everything that we can maybe think about or want to be or try to grab onto. There's always, as Jung talked about it, the shadow side of it. So these things always come in what I would call dualities. So they're the extremes that are there. And just coming back to what I was talking about with the Buddha, we're talking here about really coming right back into the present moment, right back into this balance point, this balance point. And you look at the Buddha's teachings, it's really all about that. It's all about balance, learning how to balance. And just the wonder of all this too, as we'll find out in a moment, actually, just when we do a little bit of meditation, I'll sort of do a guided meditation for you, as I usually try to do this, is this to illustrate what I'm talking about actually in the meditation. But you'll see that as we do start to practice to come to this present moment, to come deep into the moment right here and now, it is really very, very beautiful. There's it might not necessarily be as exciting as maybe flying in a space rocket or something to Mars or things like that. But you know that all of that though, that all has its opposite too. That might be exciting in that way, but the opposite of it is also it balances out. And the extremes are hard to, once you sort of get involved in extremes, it's very difficult to work with them sometimes, just as we're discovering now with these things with depressions and anxieties and a lot of the mental conditions that we have. But if you've got a good structure in your mind, if you've got a good boundary in your mind, this meditation that we learn and what the Buddha taught us to do is very, very helpful for that, because it brings us right into this present moment. And as we start to learn how to do that, we can sort of see how beautiful, how wonderful, how how relaxing it is, just how the body, it's just a joy, the relaxation of the body as it sort of settles into the moment, just settles down with itself. And then as you kind of get your body prepared and then just to let yourself go into your mind, and the mind then is already starting to take up this beautiful balance that's right there in the heart of the present moment. And so the joy and the beauty that comes from that, because as you practice this more and more, and as the Buddha said, I mean, what I'm pointing to here really is just his pathway to enlightenment. This is what he did and what he was pointing to as what his enlightenment was about. He was unifying himself. All of the conditions of his life were being unified, coming into one, so that the extremes are starting to disappear. And certainly, I suppose that's one thing you could say about enlightenment, it's really a place where all the extremes balance. I guess that's really what it is in a way that we practice to do and what enlightenment is. But just it's just an interesting thing really, when the Buddha was asked just what enlightenment is and the experience of it is, he maintained a noble silence. He wasn't able to really say, he couldn't really say. And you can understand too, if he did say or try to explain or explain the experience of it, you know, it's really, again, just another condition. It's another duality, another thing that's going to end up on that seesaw of extremes. So this is really why he was pointing to the fact that we all need to do this for ourselves. It's not something that the Buddha pointed the way to all of this, but he made it very clear that it's up to all of us to work this out for ourselves. It's not something that he can do, or it's not something that Ajahn Brahm can do. He can't make us enlightened. No one can make anyone else enlightened. We've got our own mind streams, and our mind stream, we'll start to see that now in the meditation, and I will just stop talking in a moment so that we can just practice a little bit, so I can sort of guide you in a meditation that will hopefully take you to that middle way. But the other thing that I wanted to just mention about that is that when we're doing this, we're moving towards stillness, towards the still consciousness. And as you start to realize that your consciousness can be still, our consciousness certainly creates all of this. You know, it creates the world, it creates all of it. This is one thing that we can start to learn. This is some of the wisdom that comes out of this present moment. Not by looking out into the world, trying to understand it by measuring everything out here, but just by coming back inside and learning how to be with the stillness. And as we learn to be with the stillness, that stillness brings a clarity. It brings such a clarity into our mind that we're able to see and intuit just what it is that we're dealing with here, to actually see and understand and know where the universe actually is. And for that, I'm sort of very confident to tell you that the universe and all of this really consciousness is in our own minds, in my mind, in your mind. When I'm looking out here at you, this is Dennis's world that I'm looking out onto now. And when you're looking back at me, this is your world. This is what you see. And it's up to each and every one of us to make our worlds peaceful, up to each and every one of us to make our lives enlightened, if that's the way that we sort of see it being desirable. And I think in the end, you always do that. I mean, even if you manage to, in Buddhism, we certainly, there's a big place for past lives that rebirth, that rebirth after death is all there. It's all there in the mind stream. It just continues on, this consciousness, this still consciousness that is there. And there's many things you could say about that, but I will leave my comments there now and maybe just come back to the practice, just to try and give yourself and me too an opportunity just to be still and to try and see and intuit some of the things that I've been saying here just from the stillness of your mind. And when you see and you start to work in that way with yourself, work with that way with your mind, you see it more clearly. There's more, the wisdom that's behind it all is, it just pops out. It pops out, it's just there. It's just there in the truth of this present moment, where the whole of this universe is, right here and now in this present moment. So, for those in the hall and those of you that are at home, I would like you just to take a nice comfortable position, make your back nice and straight, top of your head pointing to the ceiling so that it's not lolling too much. Always like just the right hand on the left with your thumbs just gently touching. Close your eyes. Close your mouth and just breathing through your nose. And you find that your tongue will just start to rest naturally against your palate. And you can just take a few deep breaths. Just notice that you're sitting. And we will start with just a little sweep through the body, just to relax the body, because this is all very important. Just learning what it's like when your body's relaxed. So just starting with your toes, just give them a bit of a wiggle if you want, or I always just do that, feel your socks around your feet. Everybody would have socks on tonight because it's so cold. Just feeling that fabric on your toe, and you can even pick a toe, maybe pick your second toe. Can you feel your second toe? And then in your mind's eye, just see your attention run over the arch of your foot and into your heel. And then from the heel, just moving up into the ankle. And the way that's articulated to get your foot into the right place to be connected nicely to the lower part of the leg, the shins, calves. And then just letting your attention run up through the knees. Again here, just relaxing as you go, just gently relaxing. If you need to move now, you can just move gently and just know that you're moving. And then through the knees and into the thighs, those big hefty muscles that are there in the thighs, you can experience that, just experience that sense of strength. And then through to your bottom, just as your bottom is sitting, if it's sitting on the chair or on a seat, on your cushion. And just feeling the pressure that's there on your bottom, just the way that gravity is pulling you down. And moving up into the lower part of the back, just that little arch, that curvy part at the back. And then your tummy and your chest. And if you'd like to linger there when you've got time to do this, you can really just stay there and experience lots of things, all of the little movements, the gurgles in your tummy, the little rumbles and rushes, then up into your chest, the vibrations and the beats, the rhythms. So much movement. And then just feeling your arms as they hang down by your sides, down through the upper arms, the elbows, into the forearms and the hands, wrists and hands. Then into your fingers. Just as a little experiment, just let your fingers feel nice and light and not clenched too hard in the way that you're holding your palms. And just see if you can notice around the edge of your fingers a little tingling that's going on there, just where the nerve endings finish. That little tingling. As I sometimes mention, sometimes if you're lucky, that tingling will sort of spring up and jump all over you, all over your body. It's sort of a blissful experience of relaxation. And even from here, I quite often just like to come away from my body and just notice the outside extremities of my body once I've kind of tuned into that tingling, that effervescent feeling. Just look back on your body and notice the way that it is sort of buzzing. You can sort of feel the tingling. And when this is happening, you know that you're starting to relax. Your body is really relaxing. And moving up into the neck and round your head, inside your head, behind your eyes, round your lips. And then just as another exercise, I always do like to just run through that little process of grounding myself, just knowing that it is gravity that's sort of pulling us into our seat, that's sort of causing that pressure on the underside of your bottom. And you can be sort of grateful, really, that just that gravity is there and it's holding and it's actually helping with all of the other conditions of the earth to keep your body healthy. We're sitting on the earth that is growing the food that we eat. It's holding the water that we drink. We are very much part of this earth. We're earthlings. We're grounded into the earth. You can sort of feel those, and even maybe intuit those field lines of gravity going all the way to the center of the earth and then coming back up to attach to you. And then even seeing these force or field lines sort of extending out into space, right out past the sun and the moon and right out into the universe itself. And you can sort of see that we are part of this earth, we're part of this universe. It's all right there. This universe and this earth is holding us as we are, right here and now. And it can't be any other way. We're looking right into the eye of truth. And you can see the beauty that's there, just the beauty of all of these connections, all right there in the present moment. Then when you're ready, you can just let your mind relax again, just let your mind relax, and you can just move your attention from your body and just bring it more into what we call the mind. And you can start to probably even feel now just that relaxation. You no doubt can feel the way that your mind and your body are relaxing, have relaxed. You can hear the sound of the air conditioning and the sound of my voice. But beyond that, beyond these intrusions that are just beginning and ending in your mind, you can start to see that there's a stillness there. It's not moving. There's stillness. We can see as emptiness, can be empty. We can see it as spaciousness. But also we can see it as pure consciousness. It's still consciousness. Just the stillness of consciousness not moving. And it's right there behind the words that I'm speaking. you can experience the stillness. As you notice just the frequency of my words rising and falling, beginning and ending in this stillness. You can start to see that this stillness is really the boundary of your mind, of my mind. You can start to see how the five senses of your body and mind work. The hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching. How all of these senses arise out of this stillness. And they finish in the stillness. The stillness really is like the matrix of the mind. I'm just going to stay relatively silent for a little while just to allow you just to experience the stillness without your mind moving. Just see how beautiful it is. This stillness is something you can cultivate, something you can amplify up, to be aware of, be mindful of. This stillness is the foundation of mindfulness. This is the first factor of enlightenment, the first of seven factors. Mindfulness. It's right there now. You can see that the hindrances are abating, are moving away. The first two are of desire and aversion. That dual pair, the duality of desire and aversion, is not there because your mind is still. You're not grasping at anything. And you're not trying to push anything away. It's nicely balanced. And the third and the fourth hindrances of restlessness and sloth and torpor are balanced because your mind is aware, it's awake, it's watching, alert. And you can know that the mind is still without any doubts, which is the fifth hindrance. This experience of stillness is really what will rid your mind of doubt. So the five hindrances are just there, but they're gone. They're not present. They have abated. They've moved away. Finished. Because we've moved closer to the present moment. Moved closer to that stillness. And that stillness is always there in the present moment. You can be mindful of it. Now you know you can be mindful of it. Start to feel its beauty, the joy of balance. So in a moment I'm going to ring the bell, and I'll ring the bell three times. And if you would just like to keep your eyes closed over the duration of the resonances, and just allow that time to reflect on what's happened, to reflect on what's happened for you in tonight's meditation. So I trust everybody enjoyed that meditation as much as I did. And just a reminder again too, I do want to just round off with what I've been talking about tonight, but I would like to just mention again the care group line, and just to let everybody know that that's listening in Perth and out of Perth, it doesn't really matter where you are in the world, the telephone numbers for the care line are up on your screen now and you can call. There are people there waiting to take your call. So you're very welcome to do that. But I just want to, I was emphasising in that meditation the idea of mindfulness, just, and mindfulness is just such an important thing, just being, you know, and I hope, hopefully you could see that too, or just to, and I hope you all got a sense of what that stillness is in your mind. That stillness is right there in the present moment, right there at that balance point of the present moment. That stillness is just so important to know about and to cultivate it so that you can keep using it and go back to it. But eventually, you know, you'll get to a point where you can use it as a datum in your life. And once you've got that going for you, for yourself, you're always in a great position because you're always very close to the present moment. And present moment also means that you're very close to truth. And you're not too far from the doorway to enlightenment, really, either, for all of that. So it's a wonderful place to cultivate and to practice. But I mentioned that the mindfulness is really the first factor of the seven factors of enlightenment. But I just wanted to go through the rest of them, you know, because I've been doing a little bit over the past few weeks, but I think they're very, really very important. I've kind of just come onto these seven factors myself, just to really see how important they are, really, and just how wise the Buddha was in the way that he sort of structured them. Because you've got the first one, which is mindfulness, but then once you've got the mindfulness going, then the second factor is investigation. You can investigate into things, just as we were doing at the start, investigating into this mystery of the universe, the mystery of what we're doing, the mystery of who I am. That investigation is there in the second factor. And the third factor is developing the energy. It'll just sort of naturally happens, actually, as you start to do this. This energy starts to balance. And so many ways, right through all of the Buddha's teachings, he talks about energy all of the time, virya. It's something that we really all just need to work with, just so you get that balance, you know, and you maybe felt it in the meditation, just the way when you're balanced, when you're not restless, the restlessness has moved away and the sloth and torpor has moved away and you're not kind of trying to grasp out and grab onto things. And you're not trying to push things away, you're just sort of sitting in that beautifully balanced place. And you notice what that feels like and the stillness that sort of comes, because it's balanced. You're balancing right out into the present moment, into the truth of the present moment, this truthfulness. So once that energy starts to come, and the energy starts to build, then you start with the joy and the beauty that I was trying to just highlight for you there. And hopefully that you all got a bit of a taste of that too. But as you get deeper into this, deeper into the energy of all of this, that joy and the rapture, the bliss, you know, you just you end up kind of just, you can't kind of stop wanting to be there and kind of practicing this meditation, because it's just such a wonderful thing to do. But then as that starts to take hold then too, the fourth factor the fifth factor is tranquility. The fourth factor is, you've got mindfulness, then you've got investigation, then you've got the energy that comes up, and then you've got the joy and the rapture that comes up from that energy. That's the fourth factor. And then the fifth factor is tranquility. Now, this is just amazing. I mean, this is really where your whole body does just start to become so relaxed, so tranquil, so perfectly responsive to what the universe is bringing into you, this tranquility. which is the fifth factor. And then that allows for, once that tranquility starts, then the concentration can kick in, which is the sixth factor. You're starting to really concentrate down deep, and you're starting to really look at and understand the stillness, and what consciousness is. You're starting to really see what this consciousness is. And then the seventh factor in this process that the Buddha talked about is equanimity. So knowing what equanimity is. So those seven factors, I think, are a really very important part of the Buddha's teachings, and something that you can just naturally all see in this meditation, in the way that the meditation works. Now, I don't know, Sandra, are we staying here tonight or are we moving over into the other... Okay. All right. Well, so first of all, I would just like to thank everybody for your patient listening, and thank you for everybody on the net. Remember that the care group line is open, but for those of us in the hall, I'd very much like to welcome you all over for a cup of tea with us. We can talk about things a little bit more and chew the fat, get to know each other a bit more, and hopefully I'll see you next week. Now, that's the other thing I just wanted to say too. If it all works out, next week is going to be really quite special, because next week I'm going to do a little session or an interview with one of our oldest members here, a lady called Lynn Jackson. And Lynn is really a powerhouse of this place, and also a powerhouse of meditation. So I'm really looking forward to that, because she'll be able to get, and for those overseas and listening too, it'll be a real insight for you, hopefully, of just really the foundations of this Buddhist centre, and just how it really has come to be, and just all the monasteries and that we work, and the wonderful monks and the wonderful nuns that we have, all working to bring this Dharma to the world. This lady, Lynn, was really one of the foundational members. She's like the matriarch of our society. So it's going to be wonderful to just get a reflection from her and be able to sort of hear what she's got to say about all of this. So that's next week. So I hope everybody will tune in and listen to that. And if you're living in Perth, maybe even to come along to the hall here and see it all in action. So we'll pay respects to the Buddha, Dharma and the Sangha, and then I invite you all to come for a nice cup of tea and some snacks. Good night all.